That was really stupid, honey. My name is Matthew Kroll.
And I fucking love you, you idiots. My name is Shahir Dowd.
No, this is the only podcast about movies, specifically the film Love Lies Bleeding.
You think that you should bring back the trailer voice and you do that voice?
In a world where love lies bleeding.
Two lovers will
also bleed with lies.
Yeah.
I'm not good at, you know what's funny? I'm not good at trailer voice. Classic trailer voice.
Who was the classic trailer voice? The guy who died a few years ago. And there was a movie made about him. Oh, this is someone read us into onlymoviepodcast@gmail.com. I have forgotten the name entirely. It is a famous name. And the actress who made the film. Oh, I've gone blank on all of this.
You come to our podcast for the hard-hitting and informational exposés about cinema and the people that make it. And we do. Listen, I would be disappointed in ourselves if within the first 5 minutes of every episode, we did not forget an important person's name.
Yeah, yeah. It was Donald Leroy LaFontaine, I believe, was the American voice actor who recorded more than 5,000 film trailers. And what was the movie? Movie about voice trailer guys. Anyway. It's been a week. It's been a week, and it's only Monday.
We are recording this a bit earlier than usual. We both are sort of all over the dang place. When you listen to this, dear viewers, I will be at PAX. So if you are listening to this on Saturday, if you listen on Nebula, please subscribe if you do using our code that's in the link in the description. Or Sunday, I might still be in Boston. You might be able to catch me when this will come out at 5:30. I'll be gone. I'll be leaving on a jet plane back to New York City.
And you are putting on a recurring theme in one of our PAX appearances.
That is true.
Tell me about it.
I conscripted our old, getting good at video game movies, which we've done at MAGFest, which we've done at PAX East and West, I think.
Okay.
You came out to Seattle 1 year, right?
I've done this this conversation once, but I actually don't know what is the state of video game movies now since Super Mario Brothers came out.
The panel, which will have been at in the Condor Theater at 7:30 on Friday night of PAX, is entitled "Have Video Game Movies Gotten Good?"
And
it's
they?
Basically the next. I'm not going to tell you.
Tell the listeners who are getting this on Sunday.
Listen, they should have come to PAX. And maybe if I can record it, maybe I'll put it up as a bonus episode or something. But I don't know if I actually can. Nebula exclusive, perhaps. Mm. But the gist of it was, I think filmmakers are starting to move beyond the classic, like, just take IP and run with it, and they're starting to do things around gaming, and it's just another aspect of adaptation that I find fascinating. Namely, the stuff that I'm thinking about are films like Tetris and Gran Turismo.
Okay.
Which actually, weirdly enough, the tradition of sort of those games as, as artifact films, kind of started back in, I think, 87 with The Wizard, but then we really haven't gotten a bunch of them. Like, we've done a few recently, like 8-Bit Christmas and a couple other things.
And this is where the game exists within the framework of the film, right?
Yeah, it's like the game, but like, it's so funny. I just watched Gran Turismo the other night. So here's the thing. It is an incredibly well-made movie.
Neil Blomkamp.
Like, not fucking around. Like, it is great.
Yeah.
It is crafted exquisitely. Mm-hmm. David Harbour does a kick-ass performance. But my problem with it was, no pun intended, not to talk about formula cars, but it was so formulaic. Like, it was the classic, first act, second act, third act structure with you knew exactly what was going to happen. Even though it is based off a true story, that's fine. But, like, they integrated the idea of sim racers entering a real sport based on the thing. And that was just interesting because I know it happened and it was cool to see, even though I think you could have cut like 30 to 45 minutes out of that movie and still made it much, much tighter. Mm. But regardless, I find it very interesting, like that filmmakers are starting to do things more than just either take the name and run with it and do what they want and ignore the fans, or The other thing, which actually Nando from Nando V Movies, who is on the panel as well, wrote an episode for EC about 2 or 3 years ago talking about how then there was a span starting around 2016 till maybe like 2021 or 2022 where they weren't just ignoring fans anymore for these games. They were actually courting them a bit too hard. And in that way, they kept making new protagonists that weren't part of the game's canon because they were afraid of angering like the people who made the games if they changed stuff with an existing character. So you have the new guy in Assassin's Creed, the Rock's character in Rampage. You have the human avatar guy in Sonic. Yeah. You know, it's all these like sort of like, oh, and Cole, whatever, in the new Mortal Kombat movie, which was such a fucking pointless thing. So like there was this weird like playing it safe. Mm-hmm. And then the movie, the last movie I'm going to watch before the panel here, and I'm sorry I'm rambling about this, is Resident Evil Welcome to Raccoon City.
Okay.
Which is the most recent one, not in the Mila Jovovich oeuvre of Resident Evil films. This was one where they literally take Resident Evil 1 and 2 and try to do the story of it as a movie. So, it has a 30% on Rotten Tomatoes, so I don't think lessons were learned.
Yeah.
Anywho.
I think I recall from that panel, I think one of the challenges of video game movie adaptations is interactivity versus, I guess, emotion in storytelling from, you know, like from narrative filmmaking, whereas you get that sort of emotional resonance in interactive content through the actual playing of the characters, as opposed to necessarily the storyline, even though the storyline can be emotionally resonant as well. I don't know whether that, the Gran Turismo, I think, is one that really fascinates me, just because I grew up in a culture where that game really meant a lot to a lot of people, but not from a storytelling point of view at all. You know, like it really was a technical game more than anything. It was really about building cars, you know, trying out your cars, experimenting with your cars, you know, understanding that it had nothing to do with narrative. So
the narrative is the person super passionate about all of that.
Yeah.
Nissan teams up with them to do, and this is in the real life, like with them to basically do the Nissan Academy, where the best racers in Gran Turismo, because it is a simulator, not just a game, could learn to drive race cars and possibly compete.
Yeah, I guess what I mean is, though, none of the people I knew who loved Gran Turismo as a brand had any interest in any of that. You know, like they had interest in just what the game could offer them.
They never wanted to race cars.
No, not personally for one. Oh. And also, they had no interest in going behind the scenes of a person becoming a racer or anything like that. What they were interested in was just playing the game.
Right. And to me, this scratches the itch of even like The Wizard did, the Fred Savage movie with Super Mario Brothers 3, where it's a thing you love that you're seeing someone play, like, or like that the person, the character that you're seeing's ability to play that game at such a high level, again, fictionally, or actually in this case, sort of autobiographically, or just biographically, not auto. But it's about automobiles, so I'm still right.
Barely.
There we go. I fixed it. It's just that's the interesting part, or that's where you can build narrative, just like Tetris builds narrative or takes narrative from an exaggerated, story of how Tetris came from Russia to the United States. Anyway, we're way off course.
Yeah.
But I love talking about this stuff. I'm glad that we get to do it again. Shahir, I'm sorry you won't be there. But you have said it before. You have had this conversation a few times live.
Yeah, a few times live. And I don't think at any point we've ever talked about King of Kong, which I think we should. Or that should be discussed on that panel in some way. Have you seen King of Kong, Fistful of Quarters? Yeah.
Yep.
That would be the great film to discuss in terms of video game adaptations. Not as an adaptation itself, but just the love of
documentary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we've just finished out our top 10 of 2023, which means we are starting afresh. This is a new slate, so to speak, of 2024 films. And this one made no list by A24. Matt, could you tell us what Love Lies Bleeding by Rose Glass is?
I sure could. The Internet Movie Database says, Gym manager Lou falls for Jackie, a bodybuilder who is passing through town en route to a competition in Las Vegas.
Viva.
Also, side note, yeah. This movie from A24, this podcast will be coming out on the 24th of March.
Wow. Kismet. Yeah. This has been a rough week for me in terms of like getting to getting to the movie. So I saw this last night in a very late screening, and I have basically lived my life up until seeing the movie, and then gone back to living my life. And now I'm talking about it and thinking about it for the first time. So I apologize in advance if any of my thoughts are half baked, so to speak, because it has been a little bit of a challenging day. That is suffice to say, this movie rules. And I kind of fell in love with it right away. Now, Rose Glass is a filmmaker that we have discussed her previous film on this podcast, St. Maud, a film that we both really, really liked, particularly for, I think, 5 frames at the end of the movie. Yeah. If you haven't seen St. Maud, please go check it out. It is a brilliant, brilliant first film. And a slow burn that kind of really escalates into something chaotic towards the end of its film. And what I love about seeing her second feature is that the sort of thing that excited you, which was the ability for the film to play with the surreal and the fantastical, is really extrapolated out here on a slightly bigger budget. And there are moments in this film that are quite breathtaking in the ability for the film that is kind of predictable and is a little bit of a straight line in terms of these type of genre films that we've seen before.
I'll tell you, not as predictable as Gran Turismo.
Oh, okay. Okay. I take your word for it. There is a kind of predictability in so much as there's a kind of neon swept, violent noir at the heart of this that wouldn't feel out of place having been made by Nicholas Winding Refn or in some cases David Cronenberg or the Coen brothers. There's a real genre mashup going here, and you know, none of the surprises or the twists and turns of that genre style storytelling here are particularly memorable or surprising. However, what is surprising, delightful, and exciting to watch is a filmmaker playing on a bigger canvas and playing around with bigger ideas and being able to execute them on a scale that matches their vision. We talked about this with A24 a little while back as well. I think my favorite example of this, not least of which, of course, is the fact that they produced a Best Picture winning Oscar film 2 years ago with Everything Everywhere All at Once. But when we discussed Hereditary, I mentioned the fact that what I really loved about Hereditary is it felt like there were producers on the side of the filmmaker, making decisions that are very, very challenging and would be probably thrown out in any other sort of studio situation where cost savings is a mandatory part of the actual filmmaking business. Not to say that that isn't the case with A24. And in fact, by the way, just as a side note, one of the things A24 has announced this year is that they are stepping slightly further astray from the auteur-driven movies that they have, spent the last decade really building up their name in, and into more, they want to step more into bigger budget blockbusters. Their first foray into that will be Alex Garland's Civil War, which is coming out very shortly as well.
Yeah.
Circling back to Love Lies Bleeding, I think this is a really, really beautifully made, smartly told, visually exciting, fairly standard kind of genre film, but with those little flourishes that really make it work, particularly in the casting. The sexuality of the film is obviously a major point of difference from these types of films, although there are antecedents to this, particularly the Wachowskis film Bound would be a really good antecedent to this film. But it really works, and it is at the hand of a filmmaker who really knows what they're doing. And the best thing I can say about this is a thing that is completely irrelevant today, and I'm kind of glad for it, which is that this, in at least 5 years ago, this is the type of film that would be a great audition piece for a big you know, studio blockbuster. And, you know, like the one I would kind of make a point about is that I think Marvel had been trying to figure out a Hulk film for a long time. And this would be a great audition. You know, like if I was trying to figure out a Hulk film, the first person I would talk to was Rose Glass at this point. But I think that's irrelevant now. I don't think younger filmmakers are necessarily auditioning in the same sure. way that they used to be. But this would make, you know, if you told me that Rose Glass was now on board to direct the Hulk film, I'd be like, I'd be pretty excited by that.
Yeah.
What did you think of that film?
I dug it as well. I think it's funny, a little bit of a backstory. So I went to go see it yesterday morning at 10 a.m.
Okay.
And it was a harrowing experience because, Sheer, I don't know if you've been going into the city at all these days, but the yellow line is messed up in Queens.
Okay.
To the point where there's like two shuttle buses and you have to do this other thing and go deeper into Queens and leave Queens or whatever. And I was like, oh, man, well, good thing I left early. And I popped up above ground at 57th Street and I was just going to walk. To Lincoln, and it was a half marathon.
Oh,
and great. I was like, God damn it.
All so you it fit was, people, get out of my way. I'm trying to see a movie.
Yeah, I'm trying to see a movie about someone very, very fit. And it took forever to get in there. And then I was almost late, but I got in as the previews were starting. And something I noticed about the previews was they were all, I don't know if this is true about yours, but they were all sci-fi and some horror. And Civil War.
I didn't watch the previews.
Oh, yeah. You know, I'm sorry. So it was strange because like it was a lot of them had like heavy sci-fi lean. And I was
what
like,
were the movies that were on?
I don't remember the names of them. There were many of them I hadn't even heard of. And I was like, am I in the right theater? I was like this because I didn't know. I mean, I've watched the trailer a little bit, but like it just, you know, they normally curate trailers to be somewhat on the tone, like, oh, if this audience is seeing this, they probably will like these. And then sometimes if it's a Marvel movie, it's another Marvel movie. If it's another A24 movie, they get those. So like I was like instantly off the bat, I was pleasantly like kind of like, ooh, because I was like, am I in the right thing? And then obviously the title comes up after that beautiful going in from the crevasse to overlook the town, which again felt kind of sci-fi in that moment. And then it was like Love Lies Bleeding. I was like, great. I have no idea what I'm in for. Awesome.
Yeah.
And I really did sort of enjoy the, I guess what I'll say is the hyper ride, the dabbling into the surreal journey that this movie kind of goes on. It's shot beautifully.
Extraordinary.
I could not get enough of the way this movie looked. I felt very much like St. Maud, the characters were like felt both, you know, realistic, human and interesting in that way. But then also like kind of like, and I'll say this, but not quite, I don't know how else to say it, like larger than life, but not in the sense of like giant personalities. Just like there was always something a little bit extra with everybody that I kind of liked because this movie kind of has that gritty grindhouse excess to it from time to time.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the surreal elements that kind of come in later. It's almost as if, like, basically, and this is what I'm gonna pivot a little bit into something that I don't know if it worked as well for me as it did in St. Maud. Mm-hmm. But in St. Maud, the things you questioned and the surreal elements were very religion-based. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's because I'm used to sort of like religious movies or exorcist-type stories or whatnot, like leaning into supernatural stuff. So therefore, even if it was like a, hey, did that happen? Mm. Or is it in her head or like what's going on? Like the idea of the devil doing X, Y, and Z in those movies, like that makes sense in the world where elements of this, the surrealism comes in from specifically steroid use in a weird way. Like, and not to say that that can't work and have moments of surrealism in that element, but like, especially by the end of the film, which had moments that I loved, some of the surrealist elements took me farther out of the film than St. Maud did because I feel like there's guardrails on religious or like, you know, higher power stories in that regard or things dealing with like the will of powerful entities outside of humanity. And here I got sort of what was going on, like what they were seeing and experiencing and feeling was sort of visually displayed to us. But it didn't have that sort of extra layer of like, ooh, is this really happening that St. Maud did to tie it all together? And so, again, that's my one, not even a criticism. I love what they did with this movie. I just think those moments in particular, I clocked, worked slightly less for me. And I think it was just because of how it was structurally put together in that way.
Okay, we should really get into spoilers here because I think it's going to be difficult to talk around any of the both the surreal elements, the story elements without discussing them in detail.
And the last spoiler-free thing I'll say is every actor here is at the top of their fucking game. Like, I thought everyone and Ed Harris did phenomenal.
I like that Ed Harris essentially got to do a mulligan of Pain and Gain through this movie.
Oh my God.
You know, like, I guess one of my primary references for this movie was Pain and Gain, the Michael Bay film from, I think, 2014 or 13 or something like that, with The Rock and Mark Wahlberg. And I found that that was a movie that was really pointed about the excess of Americana, you know, filtered through the lens of Miami bodybuilders, but kind of trying to do a Coen Brothers movie. And I think this was actually more in line with how that film could be successful. So I was actually kind of, and you know, Ed Harris is in both films. So it's kind of great to see him kind of live out that redo of the bodybuilder fantasy through both films. Let's get into specifics here because I think some of the interesting story details. Oh, and actually just, sorry, before we get into specifics, yes, Kirsten Stewart is a movie star. She's a great movie star. And I think Kristen Stewart, sorry.
I like Kirsten Stewart, though. That's Stewart, a fun combo.
Is a movie star, you know, unparalleled at this point. I think, you know, she has been skirting around certain movies, but also, you know, skirting around the genre blockbusters for a little bit, like films like Charlie's Angels. The redo of Charlie's Angels didn't quite work. But, you know, in amongst that, a film like Spencer, where she played Princess Diana, you know, like, and she's completely immersed in that role and completely invisible, I think is a demonstration of a really unique talent. And between her and R. Patz, you know, evident that the Twilight franchise bore out a lot of interesting talent that we're seeing now as well. And I like that what I think about Kay Stew, so I don't butcher the name, is that she's seeking out interesting filmmakers to work with, like Robert Pattinson is as well. And I think that's a really great skill to have at this point, and a great evidence of her talent is finding interesting filmmakers to work with. But the story essentially begins out as a sort of neo-noir romance where, you know, in the parlance of the old noirs, a dame walks in and changes somebody's life. And in this case, it is Katie O'Brien, who is quite a force to be reckoned with in this movie, both quite a physical force to be reckoned with and quite quite an extraordinary performance for, you know, what is, it's not her first time in films, in any film, but it is one of the first times I'm noticing her in sort of a leading role as well. And she is quite great in this.
Yeah, like I was going to say, she was also, it's funny, I didn't realize this until sort of looking stuff about the movie. She played Gentora in Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania, which was a character that had a decent amount of screen time and lines that, like, I also didn't give a shit about.
Right.
And like now seeing her in Love Lies Bleeding, I'm and being blown away. I'm like, man, what, like, what a waste in that sort of like the way they used that character. If you have this fucking phenom on your hands, like it's funny to sort of start noticing. I think she was also briefly on The Mandalorian for a couple episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I can't verify this, but I did note, I did remember seeing a story a while back that someone mentioned that they were looking for a muscle, you know, a female bodybuilder for a film, and she tweeted back, and it was for this film, or she DM'd back or put a message back, and you know, and then it came true. So you know, she really shot her shot on on Instagram, and it happened for her. And I don't know who else you would put in this role, to be honest with you. I don't know who else. You know, it felt like the role was written specifically for this actor, and that's kind of what made it so great. I will say, she for me gets a little bit lost in the roid rage towards the second half of the movie. We're not actually
She gets a little forgotten about for Kristen Stewart's Lou. And actually, in a weird way, and getting into spoilers here, kind of becomes a weird damsel in distress for a hot minute.
A hulked out.
But she's like literally captured in a compound, tied up.
Yeah.
Like, and Kristen Stewart comes to the rescue.
Yeah.
And then eventually Kristen Stewart, Lou, gets rescued by Jackie and, you know, et cetera.
I mean, this will sort of lead to maybe some of my criticisms of the strength of the narrative here, is that I was really invested in the romance of these two characters finding each other. And, you know, the question marks around is Lou, or is Jackie really just using Lou because she needs a place to crash? Is Lou,
right,
you know, like, really gonna be there for her when she's gonna go to Vegas? You know, what is Lou's past and that sort of thing? And then Lou's relationship with her sister and her father, and obviously her brother-in-law, who Dave Franco meets a jaw-breaking fate in this movie. You know, I think the thing is that the romance ultimately gets lost. These two characters kind of get split up for a while. And when they reunite, it's really just a quick propulsion forward towards the end of the film. I would have ordinarily said what that does is make me feel a little bit sad for the lack of being able to see these two characters together for so long. But it's made up for the fact that Rose Glass is such a great hand on the surreal here, and really build towards a crescendo and a final shot with these two. Not a final, well, yes, a final shot, but also a final fantasy sequence between these two characters that really does all the heavy lifting of what I missed out on for the rest of the movie. It might not be as emotionally tethered to what I enjoyed about these two characters just being on screen, but it was visually so exciting to watch that I was kind of like, yeah, this is their world, and I'm just living in it, and I like it.
Sure.
And essentially, I'm talking about the fact that Jackie becomes a giantess, you know, for no apparent reason other than it's a sort of a wonderful fantasy, a wonderful power fantasy by the end of this movie. And then we see the two lovers kind of running across the clouds as two giant characters that may not be out of place in Ant-Man versus the Wasp in Quantumania. Is that what it was? I don't know.
Yeah, that's close enough.
Yeah.
And then, like, it instantly cuts back to them just, like, in their shitty truck driving with a body in the trunk.
Yeah.
The body, by the way, of Anna Bereshunkov. Daisy, who, listen, what a fucking wonderful character that I would never want to spend a fucking second with.
Yeah.
Like, what a, like, that twist that sort of happens with her, like, after the murder of one Franco brother, when they have to sort of, you know, get rid of the body in a very creepy and cool way.
There's a lot of rolling up people in carpets in this movie.
Yeah.
There's a lot of carpet rolling.
But Daisy runs into them driving in. Daisy's been trying to, like, get with Lou and doesn't, or maybe has a history or past or something, but definitely, like, is like just a bit of a townie and a bit of a weirdo. also, just has a very methamphetamine vibe.
Yeah.
And the way that she's like, oh, I was thinking about you. What are you doing? Why are you in this car? Why is she in your truck? And then, like, she uses that to sort of blackmail Lou to, like, sleep with her and be in, like, a little faux relationship so she won't tell the cops. But then, like, that all ties in because Ed Harris, who plays Lou's father, who runs a fucking shooting range, but also, like, runs guns for the cartels, apparently. And Dave Franco's character JJ worked for it. And then Jenna Malone, who plays Beth, who's Lou's sister, is beaten by JJ. Like, there's so many interconnecting things in this movie The world, it's funny. There's a lot of web in this movie, but it never feels overly connected. Mm. Like, it feels like this is a small ass town, and this woman, Jackie, rolled up into it as a stop off before she was going to Vegas, and she's now in the middle of everyone's shit. Granted, due to need, like, she gets a job by sleeping with JJ. She gets a place to stay by sleeping with Lou, except she actually loves Lou. And it's interesting, like you said, Shahir, when that there's a moment where, like, unbeknownst to a few of them, they're at dinner. Like, Beth, yeah. JJ, Jackie, and Lou are all at dinner. And JJ leaves for a second and comes back, and Lou confronts her near the bathroom. And JJ basically lets Lou know, like, yeah, she slept with me to get a job. Like, yeah. What do you think she's sleeping? She's sleeping with you and she's staying at your house. And then you have the doubt seed put in. Like, there's a lot of really wonderful small narrative moments with all the interconnectivity that makes everything feel real and have you kind of guessing about a couple different things throughout the film. It's I don't know. It's great when you can have someone as like likable as Katie O'Brien's Jackie that also, yeah. Because of different things and the way the movie is setting up around her, you can also like stop trusting her for a little bit.
Yeah.
Like it's cool.
I think it's really well written out and well worked. I wondered a little bit about like whether the sort of connectivity of it actually landed in an emotionally resonant place. This is what I'll say is that I understood that the film was telling me that Ed Harris's Luge Sr. was a dangerous character. What I couldn't understand was why he was allowing for such a dangerous character, why he knowingly allowed his daughter to be beaten by JJ, what seemingly repeatedly. Like it wasn't the first time it had happened and nobody was blind to the fact. And he was a character who seemingly very aware of everything that was going on. And I was kind of curious I started asking a lot of questions about like, what is the nature of this relationship that would make this incredibly dangerous man allow his daughter to be beaten? Given that he has a history of murdering people. I spent a lot of time asking that question to myself. Through the film. And I think that kind of distracted me a little bit from actually engaging in the twists and turns.
Well, there's something interesting. I mean, obviously, Lou Sr. is a very selfish man, but he kind of loves his daughters in a odd, fucked up way. So I was wondering that, too. But I do think the speech he gives when she's in the hospital unconscious to Lou or around then, saying like, this is her husband, like she wouldn't want him gone or dead. Right. And so he's like, I'll talk to him. And he does go and try to talk. I mean, we have no idea what that would ever be, because by the time Lou Sr. goes to talk to JJ, JJ's fucking done.
Also, I just didn't understand why like JJ would be that. I don't know what the word is for it, but like he works for a very dangerous man who happens to be his father-in-law.
JJ also was an informant.
Was he?
Did you catch that?
Oh, I didn't pick that up.
He was the FBI guys or the whoever mentioned that when he dies that he was their best informant.
Okay. The FBI guy was an interesting part as well. There was a little bit of like not quite understanding the connections of the storyline in a sort of clear way that did ordinarily take me a little bit out of it. Other than the fact that the kind of fantastical elements of this really landed, like landed in a way that most films would never be able to do. Like, I love the kind of vision of Jackie as a giant woman. Essentially, my only visual reference for this is the Hulk, but like we see the sort of pulsating of her muscles.
Yeah, you hear the crack and the muscles grow.
Yeah, and she's kind of constantly growing. And then like when Lou is in trouble, she kind of finally rages out and becomes this sort of giantess. It's a sequence that requires all cylinders to be firing in how the film is working. And in this case, it's like, it needs to kind of be a David Cronenberg horror as well as a Coen Brothers mystery or a Coen Brothers kind of like crime film. And to put those two things together is incredibly difficult to do, and to pull them off like they do, like she does in this film, is really, really miraculous. So I think it kind of worked for me.
I actually don't know, for me personally, if the giantess moment worked. I think that was the only moment truly of the movie where I was like, okay. And I think I know why. So the other big surreal moment is when Jackie finally gets to Vegas and does the competition, but she's roided out.
Yeah.
And she's going for it. And then she starts hallucinating that she actually vomits out Lou, who says something to her. And then it cuts away and she just vomited on the stage.
Yeah.
So in that entire thing, the surreal moment, again, kind of like St. Maude does a couple different times with the character wondering what's real and what's not. But like, you kind of get the feeling that it's not real and they're just sort of experiencing it in their head. It's only something that she saw. We see the real life after. I get the surrealist moment.
Yeah.
Now, we never see outside, like, but then when you make the giantess moment happen, the other characters react and look up to the eye line of her as well. And so this is something that reads as really happening, which again, I don't even care if it's really happening or not in the movie. Like, you know, I don't, but it starts making more hoops than I was able to cleanly jump through.
Right.
And again, not saying it wasn't cool and I don't love the swing. And I think that it was a neat moment. Especially, I think the only way that actually makes it land for me is honestly that last shot in the truck afterward, because we're reminded, like, you know, whatever. But like, that means that there has to be sort of like, and this is possible, and I wouldn't say like a mass hallucination, but like, she's so dangerous in that moment that both Lou Sr. and Lou see her as that thing. Like, there's totally a way that that could make sense. Yeah. It just... it felt, it was supposed to feel like a culmination of like the entirety of her journey in a way.
Yeah.
And I think the intrinsic sort of silliness knocked it back for me a step.
So the only thing is I just accepted it as fantasy because is not a, is not a metaphysical, you know, like she's not growing into being a giantess. I just accepted it as fantasy of how it's being played. I think to your point, and this is a story note that, you know, like I would possibly give, is to connect Jackie's historical trauma that she has discussed, you know, that is kind of loosely based throughout the film about having been adopted, having run away from home, being a fat kid that was bullied and learning how to fight. Mm-hmm. If somehow, if all of that culminated in that sequence, then we would kind of understand the poetic relevance of that image as opposed to just the visual image of that image.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. That'd be nice.
And I think that's also... in reverse, the story, you know, like whereas I was having trouble connecting some of the story elements together and I wanted them to be a little bit more understood throughout the beginning of the film as well. But regardless, I still think this is, you know, I was still loving the kind of both the unique voice of what this film was, the unique identity of what this film was, the unique musical choices about that this film was making. You know, like it was trance music at some point, it was hypnotic, it was country music at some point. It was just really all over the map, but it really depicted to me a filmmaker who was like trying things out and had really interesting ideas to play with here. And really worked. You know, I think for an audience like A24 trying to find the sort of horror in this, the bone crusher, the jaw crushing moment is quite a sort of surprise. And it might be that first time where you're like, is that what roids really do? Like, I don't know, you know, like what roids really do. Like, do they induce hallucinations?
You have no idea.
Yeah. And it shows, by the way, I'm a little natty. But yeah, you know, like I was sort of like wondering the whole time, is like, is this what roids does? And is this how it work? Cause I don't think it is, but.
Well, you can, from my understanding, again, I have not done steroids as illustrated by my physique. You can fly into an uncontrollable rage.
Right.
I don't know what you're seeing in those moments or whatever, but
also like there's a moment where like After Jackie has shot Daisy, when she's like stumbling back in a sort of hallucination, she almost looks like she stops a car with her body.
Oh,
like,
I didn't see that.
I think the car just kind of stops in front of her, but she's like really raging out like the Hulk at this point.
Sure.
And I'm like, is this what happens? I'm not exactly sure. But it doesn't matter, because I don't think it's of much value to read this as a realist take.
No.
As anything but genre fantasy.
And I don't want my criticisms to come across as that thing.
Yeah.
It's just in the fantasy of it. Due to a couple things I think we went over, it just didn't quite land for me the way the rest of the film does. I do want to say that one of the things that truly landed for me, and again, you said it perfectly, is that Kristen Stewart is just a grade A movie star.
She's just terrific on screen.
Here's the things that there are elements, and here's how you know. There are elements in every Kristen Stewart performance that no other fucking actor could do and pull off in the same way. And the moments in this one, there's two, and they're very small. There's a moment in the trailer, actually, you can go watch it right now if you haven't seen this movie, where Lou Sr., Ed Harris, is on the phone, and he basically says, you know, are you threatening me? And the music and the tone in the background is very, the whole scene and the conversation on the phone between Kristen Stewart and Ed Harris is crazy tense.
Yeah.
And Kristen Stewart eventually, with perfect timing, thank you, editors, comes back with just a
yep.
and it's not, this is why she's a master. It's not funny. Like it is enjoyable to hear and feels incredibly real for the character, and is an odd response to that tense moment in the way that we've been trained in movies like this to have those moments. Like, I think the polar opposite of the spectrum, even though it is played for farce, is Chris Evans playing Lucas Lee in Scott Pilgrim, where he's on this payphone. He's like, you know, you're going to regret all the rest of your life, all 2 seconds of it. And he like slams down the phone. Like, it's like the listen up, bucko, like just those hard action movie like retorts to the villain saying, like, are you threatening me? Here, Kristen Stewart has a ferocity and an intensity and a truth in her character Lou just by saying the word yup.
Yeah.
And in any lesser actor's hands, that would come off as either a joke or not work. Right. And here it just flows. Another moment specifically is we sort of learn through some audio tapes in the beginning and a couple visual cues that she's a smoker, but she's also like maybe trying to quit smoking.
Yeah.
And in one of the bodies, I think it is JJ's body, at a certain moment when she's dealing with it, she sees his smokes that yeah. he had Beth run out for. And she like stops and thinks about pulling, like just taking the smokes off the body. And she just goes, nope, nope. And she keeps going.
Yeah.
And like, again, small moment, but it turns this character who's in a roughly fantastical, eccentric world and grounds her.
Yeah.
Like, and makes it feel real. And I think I can't see another actress sort of pulling that off as effectively, those small moments like she does in this film and in many of her films.
I think you're right. And like, just to give fair credit there, as I think a lot of that is good storytelling in terms of the writing, allowing her to have those moments. But the other thing is that there is an odd reveal in this film, which again is one of those things where I say it doesn't really feel surprising, but it's also like it's sometimes a little bit hard to reconcile, which is that Lou Jr. was a sort of trainee hit person for Lou Sr. at some point.
Yes.
And then stopped doing that and eventually goes off to run the gym. I think the sort of you do have to reconcile this idea that this person who we've met at the gym, who is kind of like, well, to you know, a ne'er-do-well who's like trying her best and like lives under sort of interesting circumstances, but is trying her very best. It did used to be a hit person, and I couldn't quite reconcile that, other than she knew where to dump the body but then did it poorly. And I
she didn't do it poorly. She did that's the cool part.
She did it on purpose because she wanted the other bodies to be found there, and she wanted to kill two birds with one stone, so to speak.
I thought that was super clever because it's right in the movie. You're like, oh no, wait. And she's like, no, that's the fucking plan. And you're like, oh, like it's, I don't know. I liked that a lot.
I do actually, sorry. Yeah, you're right. I do like that idea, but I guess I wasn't sure that this person was like as familiar with the process of creating hits and being, being a hitman, you know, like I just wasn't quite sure that it didn't quite ring true to the character I was seeing on screen. But again,
I think she did an execution for him. I don't think she like was a active like muscle hitman for him. I never got that vibe.
I just got the sense that there was a history here where she was involved in that world.
But like I don't think she was ever like more competent than we see her in this. It's not like she's not John Wick retired,
right?
You know?
Yeah. You might be right.
And it's funny, like her character, you know, reconciling that she's killed people and doing all that stuff. I feel like in many men-led films like this, it's like John Wick specifically.
Yeah.
John Wick's a fucking hitman. And then we fall in love with him because he adopts a dog after his wife dies and all is forgiven. That man has murdered countless people and we don't know if they deserved it or not.
Yeah.
So we don't question that. So I'm not really questioning Lou here either. Like,
that's a very, very fair point. Richard Brody wrote for The New Yorker a really interesting piece, which had some sort of criticisms of this as a genre exercise, in so much as that he wasn't sure why some of the choices that were being made were made. And one of them was the 1989 sitting.
I love it. I love it so much.
I love that it's a particular sitting, but I think Richard Brody makes a really good point, which is like, what function does it serve in the storytelling, particularly when you hear like the television telling us about the Berlin Wall, for example? Like, what does that part of the story tell us that it was that needed to be specific to this date or this time? And I think that's a very fair point to this, which is that like the sitting, while cool and made it 1989, and for me, made it feel akin to, you know, the Coen brothers' Blood Simple, was like, oh, why? Yeah. Was there a specific reason other than cell phones? You know, like that's my default reasoning for why people choose past dates.
One. But I don't think a movie needs a moment. It's a choice, right?
It's a clear choice.
Yeah, but it could be. It could be pure aesthetics. Like, you could look at that time period in that place and be like, I really want my movie to be set here because I want a certain look. Like, I don't think it needs to specifically be like crucial to the story. Now, to your point, the Berlin Wall moment. I'm trying to remember what exactly was going on during that thing when it was on the TV. What moment of the movie was happening?
I'm not entirely sure, but it was just a very pointed like moment where I was like, oh yeah, the Berlin Wall is happening right now as well. What is that telling us about the context of this story?
And it's interesting that both of us can't remember that, like what was happening in that moment. Because I would say in that case, whatever connective tissue is there probably didn't work right. Because we don't remember, we remember the Berlin Wall being mentioned in the background of a TV thing and like going and we're hearing about it while stuff was happening, but neither of us remember that moment.
Yeah.
Why it was relevant
to happen. So it might be there on a second viewing too.
Yeah, maybe. What I'll say to that though, I think is, I think this movie was set in 89, first and foremost for aesthetics. And then they pulled things like the Berlin Wall. It felt like it as a secondary thing of like, oh, this could probably tie in here. If we do a thing here, this could be neat. I don't think like they were like, it's so important to the story that this movie is in 89 because the Berlin Wall, you know, I don't think it was that. I think it was sort of like a side thing that, where they were looking
for more.
It's
just a very specific thing.
It's a specific choice.
It's a very, very specific choice. And you sort of wonder, you're left wondering about it. But again, I think, as I've kind of said a couple of times here, is like, I think there's a folly in sort of reading this too much more than a really excellent example of a genre of a story in a genre executed really, really well and really smartly in a way that very few people can do. And for that reason alone, it's a triumph. And then, you know, not least of which, we don't get much LGBT content where with, you know, queer leads at the helm of it, being able to express themselves freely and their sexuality freely and not really have it commented upon in the film. You know, yeah. like not have it become an issue, particularly in 1989 America.
Well, what's great is there's the one moment in the beginning with the muscle bound dude that like says something derogatory, and then there's nothing else. Even like Ed Harris's Lou Senior is a fucking piece of shit, but he has no problem with it.
Yeah,
what are you gonna say?
Oh no, there was something about the way his house was coated with like classical music playing in the background. That was kind of Scarface, you know, like it was it was very like the final boss of a John Wick movie as well. Mm-hmm. That made me like, I don't know. But then the other film that I sort of thought about a lot in this film, in this genre, was Mandy, the Panos Cosmatos film that we discussed as well, in terms of like that fantastical side of it, that sort of hallucinatory quality to the film. And, you know, by the time she ends up walking up the stair, like the almost Roman steps of his, palatial mansion with classical music blaring through what must have been an incredible Phonos record player system in that time. Well, maybe it was a CD player.
He's the Maxell guy, like the chair. shout out if you're old enough to remember that shit.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what system he would have had in that house. But again, 1989. It works because the film so commandingly builds a world for us to accept.
And there's other minor things I want to call out, specifically with the characters of Lou Senior and Daisy. Mm-hmm. They do things that great villains or antagonists, I love when in movies this happens.
Yeah.
Lou Senior is a bug guy.
Mm, yeah.
He collects beetles and larvae.
Yeah.
And it's never really like important to the story, but you can tell it serves two points. One, it makes you realize that there's something behind this guy. He has like hobbies outside of just running guns and trying to control his family. And two, it adds that creep factor and that questioning of like, what's really this fucking dude's deal? And then with Daisy, there's small things. Obviously, you know, you can tell she's a bit of a tweaker, but also she's always drinking milk or dairy products.
Right. I didn't notice that.
And like, it's just strange, but you get like this person has a proclivity for this thing. And like, whenever you can have characters have small choices like that, I mean, the bug one's a little bigger than the milk one, but like, I love that because it makes them feel real, even though they're fucking extreme.
And
it's just cool.
And Lou Senior eventually eats one of the bugs, right?
eats one of the bugs.
I couldn't quite clock this. As someone who might have watched this recently, does Daisy have braces at the beginning of the film and then they're removed in the second half? And then she's like, her teeth are all
She has the sort of what happens when you
right
when
in you the in the dark. I wasn't sure if she had braces in those.
No, just there's that film that thing that happens.
Yeah. And you know, like her desire for margaritas first thing in the morning or a milkshake first thing in the morning is kind of interesting as well.
Yeah.
And I think also Lou Jr.'s kind of like willingness to go along with this all, knowing that you know, this is a foil that she's going to have to outthink at some point.
Yeah,
I think is really, really smart. Again, I kind of wish Jackie was a little bit more in there. She does kind of like pop up and eventually kill Daisy, but only at the behest of
Lou Senior.
Well, and you know, so she gets a little lost in
that weird like jealousy thing where the two lovers are now like questioning one another and like or what like I don't know, that happens in all this shit. Like, it's very tropey.
Yeah,
but everything else around it is so interesting that a trope is just there because it's crazy popular.
Yeah.
Like, and if you can do cool things around that trope, rock and roll.
But the defining feature would be is if the film can elevate beyond the trope to something honest and real and within this sort of like spectacular framework. Like, so I think from an aesthetic point of view, if the final moments of the film, if the final fantasy of the film had been, oh my God, Jackie has come to save Lou because she's so in love with her, that would be kind of amazing. Instead, it's kind of Jackie has come to save Lou, and that's really cool, and it's in this really cool visual way that I think is dynamic and interesting and unexpected. And I
think it's because she loves her, but yeah.
But you know, like, were you sort of elated at their reconnection at the end of the film, or?
I liked it, but again, I liked it once they were in the truck again.
Yeah, I think it works better in the truck when Daisy wakes up and Lou has to kind of go bury her body.
And Jackie, like, Lou is taking care of Jackie. Lou is, or Jackie's sleeping in the truck, and the credits start rolling as Kristen Stewart is dragging a body into the desert.
And she does the thing that you talked about earlier, which is that she takes out a pack of cigarettes from Daisy's pocket and starts smoking it again.
It is the payoff.
Yeah.
It's so nice.
It shows, like, where the fun is to be had in this film, right? It's like the absurdity of these two people, these two runaways now, like the characters from Badlands, you know, like making their way across country, entering bodybuilding competition and murdering people along the way. You know, it's a complete movie fantasy, and it's kind of funny. Yeah. I really, really enjoyed my time watching this movie. I think it works on most levels. It doesn't quite, you know, elevate the storytelling, but
the form, if you will.
Yeah, the form, but it is so unexpected. And that is worth the price of admission. And I really, really, you know, again, am here for whatever Rose Glass wants to make next, kind of thing.
Yeah,
you know,
same. It is a welcome film. That is sort of what I will say. If its minor flaws do not matter because of how welcome I find this movie. This is a movie by someone who loves fucking movies and loves making things look cool and going a little over the edge and telling real human characters like stories that also can have them be like eccentric as fuck and still have it work. And it's cool.
It's weird that essentially this is on the other end of the spectrum of Pain and Gain. You know, it is kind of the same appeal, you know, like to Pain and Gain, but you know, and I've rewatched Pain and Gain a couple of times to try to figure out if I actually like it or not. I really, really like this film, and I really, really, really want to see more of her filmography moving forward. And I think it's also a great big screen movie. It's a great, really great big screen kind of movie. It looks great on screen. It harkens back to the Coens in terms of Blood Simple, but at the same time, oddly, a really, really effective body horror. And it shows, you know, an artist kind of growing further into their space, and I'm here for that.
Indeed. Well, this has been the only podcast about the film Love Lies Bleeding. Shahir, when you are not in a totally clean manner, oiling yourself up and getting your flex on for all of your adoring fans, where can folks find you?
I think my wife once described me running through the house with a towel on as akin to Zoidberg from Futurama outside of his shell. You can find me across my house at my website, www.shahirdaud.com. That's SHAHIRDAUD, or my company site, suvanova.com. That's SUVANOVA. Matt, when you are hallucinating and while simultaneously experiencing enough roid rage to make you as big as the Hulk, where can people find you?
You can find me quitting after this last cigarette, because I can quit anytime I want, over at my website, matthewcarroll.com, for my life and works. Also, Skeletor, the number 4, PREZ on Instagram or PSN. Hey, want to play some Helldivers with me once I'm back next week and have a moment to breathe? Sign on and friend me on there, and we'll go fight for Super Earth and spread democracy across the planet. Helldivers, Shahir, if you're not familiar.
I have no idea what you're just talking about.
The farcical nature of Starship Troopers with the serial numbers filed off. Like, it is a complete and utter farcical allegory nonsense thing, and it's wonderful. Emperor MSK on Twitter, and of course Matthew Kroll on Blue Sky. Check out the good works we're doing over at Extra Credits. By the time this airs, we'll be in sports territory for Extra History. We'll be doing Jim Thorpe will have just aired, and I believe the one that is coming right after is John L. Sullivan, who will lick any son of a bitch in the house. No, it's an old-timey boxing reference, Shahir. Very interesting stories there. Anyway, and then on Extra Credits, we have just released our, basically, we're naming an episode Skeletor Wants Your Cash, and it's about how the Fortniteification of video games, like, companies are learning the wrong lessons from Fortnite, and everyone's trying to do this sort of like IP slurry of bullshit, but it's not going to work, and it's going to make games worse. But it's an interesting episode, and I get to do a Skeletor voice in it, so yay. Next week
I'm hoping to resume a normal life. You know, I'm working like 15-16 hours a day right now, so I'm hoping to resume a normal life. And I'm not actually sure what's on the table for next week. Is Civil War out next week? Is this just going to be the A24 year?
It might be. Let's take a look live on thing. Went Civil War release date.
But the one thing I will say is that for the first film out of the gate of 2024, it's pretty great. Although we did do Dune 2 as well.
It's April 12th.
It's April 12th. There's still a couple of movies hanging over from last year that I would still love to do, like All of Us Strangers and The Teacher's Lounge. And also, coming up to our birthday episode, we always do something on our birthday.
Fuck.
We got to think of something for there. This is going to be the year of the 500th episode, I believe. So we got to build up to that as well. Yeah.
Shit.
I think so. I think it's going to happen this year or early next year. I don't know. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Can we hold
it'll
out?
Happen this year because we're only in March now and this is episode 470-something.
Yeah. Well, you guys have all of that to listen forward to. Email us in onlymoviepodcast@gmail.com. Hit us up with your top 10s if you still got them. Talk to us about movies that you're seeing. Enjoy the spring. I love that Daylight Savings has started again. I'm a much happier person, even though I'm like overworked at this moment.
I don't go outside.
Really? I Daylight Savings is when I will use any excuse to go outside.
I mean, I should, but I just don't. Anyway, until then, watch a bunch of movies, probably inside, though if you can go to a drive-in, do that, because it's fun. Later, everybody!
Fun during the daytime. Bye, everyone.